Welcome to the Your Oxygen Mask First podcast. I'm Erin Young, and this is a space where we explore ways to help the helpers. Because you can't help anyone before you help yourself. So sit back, put your own oxygen mask on, and enjoy the ride. We are so honored today to be joined by a man that, while has so many accomplishments and titles that there's no way I have time to list them all right here. We are talking with Scott Mann, who was a Green Beret, a public speaker, including TEDx, so exciting, a podcaster himself, leadership expert, and now a playwright and an actor. Whew! There are so many things we could talk about with this amazing guy, but today we are going to find out more about his production, Last Out, and how it's helping veterans improve their mental health. Thank you so much for joining us, Scott.
Hey, thanks, Erin. You know, as I was listening to you rattle those off, I thought, man, you talk about a midlife crisis. you know, but a lot of those I took on very, very late in my life, in all seriousness. And it's, I think maybe, you know, when I think about what I do more than anything is storyteller, which I think you do as well. And that kind of helps unify all those disparate bodies of work. But I appreciate you letting me be here. It's a real honor.
Well, the honor is all mine, but let's jump right into it and tell us briefly. I know it's hard because you have so much experience, but wrap us around a little bit of your background and why you chose a life of service.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm a Green Beret. I retired 6 years ago. I spent 23 years in the Army, 18 of that as a Green Beret. I decided to become a Green Beret when I was 14 years old, when a Green Beret walked into the soda shop of our little one horse town in Mount Ida, Arkansas. I loved the way the guy looked. I loved the mission that Green Berets do, which is basically parachuting in behind enemy lines. And they kind of do, it's kind of Lawrence of Arabia meets Magnificent Seven. Like they do their relationship-based connectors who work with local tribes and indigenous people to stand up on their own against oppression from the inside out. And I just fell in love with that concept. I think it was because I was a little guy growing up and I always was the underdog. And there was something about a team of 12 men who would go into an area, build relationships, immerse in the language and the culture and lead from a place of connection and story and relationships. And I just fell in love with that. So that's what I did for, you know, nearly two decades. And then when I retired, I decided to take those same lessons of building relationships and connection in trust depleted places using things like storytelling and active listening, interpersonal skills for leadership and teaching it to, you know, corporate leaders, but also helping veterans use those skills as they come home and transition. And so that's the Reader's Digest version of what I do today.
Well, that's amazing. So tell us a little bit more about what you love most about your time in the military.
The people. What I loved most about my time in the military was the work with people. My teammates, other high performing special operators who loved the mission, who loved their country, who loved this work of working by, with, and through indigenous people to help them stand on their own. And those indigenous people, those local villagers, those local tribes in other countries and other places, I absolutely relished, Erin, making connections with those people, learning about their culture, immersing in their way of life, and building deep relationships, and then leading them to do things they otherwise wouldn't do. I loved it so much that I took that same skill set and mindset and created what I call rooftop leadership, which is a methodology of inspiring people to climb up ladders, much like villagers did in the Afghan villages, and making a stand together. And that's what I loved about that kind of work, is just the human connection, the interpersonal relationships, and the opportunities to make deep connections.
Which I absolutely love, because you're so relatable. You appeal to the military personnel, but you also appeal to the civilian side too. I feel like anything that you say or you bring up, your methodologies can apply to a corporate person, like you said, or maybe someone who's in public safety. It's pretty, very broad.
Yeah. And you know, you using the word relatable, Erin, is really cool, because, you know, I still teach interpersonal skills, relationships, human connection at Special Ops University. I teach it at Fort Bragg to the Green Berets going through the course. I teach it to federal law enforcement. And one of the things I always tell these folks when they have to go in and make connections in these very trust depleted places is remember that humans are meaning seeking, emotional, social creatures, right? So whether, and this is all humans. So whether you're going into a trust depleted dusty village or whether you're getting up in front of an audience of 500 people to do a keynote, we are, as social creatures, we're always evaluating the people in front of us, determining whether or not we can relate to them, because we have survived for hundreds of thousands of years based on our ability to form groups and teams and overcome what Mother Nature throws at us. So if you're relatable as a leader, you are relevant as a leader. And that is absolutely essential. So cool that you picked up on that.
That's very quote-worthy. I'm going to have to write that down. Relatable equals relationships and equals good leadership.
Well, even further, you could say relatable equals relationships equals relevance, and people follow relevance. That's what they follow.
Absolutely.
We follow the person who's relevant to our pain. We follow the person who's relevant to our dreams. And if you stop and think about it, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if you have a leader that comes in that has no clue about your job and what you do, has never done that, never been there, how can you relate to them and trust them that they have your best interest at heart?
Exactly. And that's why it's so cool that you're doing this podcast, because one of the most powerful ways that, you know, and so think about that from a veteran in transition, right, who's coming back from service. If the employer or the donor or the investor can't see that veteran as relatable, then they're not going to hire them, buy from them, or invest in them. So this notion of making yourself relatable is necessary in every aspect of our life if we're going to be successful.
That's huge. Mm-hmm. And then also too, and granted, I'm a civilian, so I'm not very exposed to how things run in the military, but I love to learn and I love to make the connections that I have with the veterans that I have spoken to. It's really opened my eyes and really helped me actually in my job, dealing with some of the calls that I've had with veterans who call in that may be in crisis. But does the military teach you to shut yourself off from that relatability in a way? Because you're looking at the enemy, they're less than human in a way. How do you deal with that contrast?
Wow, what a great question. You're good at this. You should have a podcast.
Oh, no, I'm kidding. Maybe I'll think about it.
No, I think that's exactly right. In fact, that's one of the things that I've noticed in my work through the Hero's Journey, which is our nonprofit that helps warriors find their voice and tell their story as they come home from service. I've noticed that, and this was the same for me, you know, like in Special Forces, we have this mantra that we are the quiet professionals, right? You don't talk about yourself. You just do your job. Everything else sorts itself out. That's fine when you are in the military, right? But if you take that quiet professional mantra to heart when you come out of service and you don't find a way to communicate who you are, where you've been, and where you're going, then it's going to be very, very difficult for civilians on this side to understand your relevance, your relatability to their world. And so, yes, I do think that we condition not only our military members, but our family members in the military to clam up, not talk about yourself, and just let your merits, your actions, and your deeds speak for themselves. That, again, that's fine in the military. But when you change planets into the civilian world, if you don't have narrative competence, in other words, the ability to use story to communicate, again, who you are, where you've been, where you're going, it's going to be very difficult for civilians to pull you in and give and work with you in the things that you need to be happy.
I absolutely agree. And I think maybe there's this misconception among military people is that they're trying to protect the rest of us from what they've dealt with, so they don't talk about it. Not really realizing that we're a little bit more resilient than we appear. And, they're always the protectors. They're protecting us, but it benefits everybody to share a little bit of what happened on the other side.
That's great. And that's right, Erin. Let's go a step further with that. Let's understand that in every society on the planet, we have experienced war, and young men and women go off and they fight wars. And what happens is that societies, tribal societies, for centuries, if not thousands of years, have used storytelling to assimilate, reassimilate, reintegrate warriors back into society. We have always done this, except in the United States. We do not use storytelling as a way to reintegrate our warriors. And as a result of that, especially when you start introducing traumatic brain injury and PTS, you start to, you know, that absence of narrative, considering that humans are story animals, we think and act in story. So when we cut that off, then we are no longer able to articulate our purpose and who we are and our identity to the world around us. And so we become isolated and we are actually out of touch with our nature. We are designed to use story to reconnect into our communities, and we're not doing it. And so as an when that's absent, I think it really puts not only the veteran at risk, but it puts the whole community at risk.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you hear the negative connotation, the spin on war stories. Oh, that's just Joe. He's telling another war story. But there's a reason for it, and it's important. And like you said, we've gotten away from it. So what are your thoughts about the negative connotation of war story? And two, follow up to that is, I think I've read somewhere that when you tell a story over and over again, I think it's called exposure therapy, that you're no longer living as a character inside that story. You're not there anymore. The more you tell your story, the more it becomes a story and you are removed from it.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Those are two great questions. So the first thing is on this negative connotation of war stories. This is what I would say to any veteran who's coming home or transitioning or has already transitioned is, first of all, remember that humans are story animals. We've been telling stories for 100,000 years, longer than we've been speaking language. We've only been speaking language for 10,000 years. So we've been telling stories around fire pits for a very long time, so much so that our brains and our bodies are conditioned for storytelling. So the human brain actually processes the world around it using story. Story, according to Dr. Kendall Haven, is a sense-making tool. It is the primary decision mechanism and sense-making mechanism, context mechanism for every human on the planet, right? And that hasn't changed in a quarter of a million years. So we still use story to make sense of the world around us. Now, if, for example, a civilian back home sees a veteran and that veteran does not use narrative to communicate who they are, where they've been, and where they're going, then that other person will form their own story in their mind to fill in the gaps. And just like every human does, two things will happen. One, they'll probably get it wrong. And two, they'll be just a little bit aggravated that they had to develop their own story instead of hearing it from the relevant party. So as a returning veteran, when you use story to communicate who you are, it really helps reduce the perception gaps in the people at home. Now, there's a second part to that, which is stories should be told responsibly. Telling war stories for the sake of saying this one time at band camp, like, that is in the service of the teller. And that is a very arrogant, egotistical thing to do. And that's why people get put off by it. If, however, you tell stories in the service of others, which is what they're designed to be. 100,000 years ago, if I staggered into the fire circle and I said, let me tell you guys why saber-toothed tigers make crappy pets, right? You'd be all, you know, and I'm all bloodied up. You'd lean in and you'd listen because you can learn autobiographically through my story. Well, same thing. If I tell you today why storytelling and human connection in the dusty villages of Afghanistan can help you make better understanding, that can help you make better connection in sales, I've used story to serve you. And that's where we're missing the point. Stories for returning veterans should be told in the service of the people we're telling them to. And that takes practice.
That was the link I was missing. Perfect.
Yeah. And so that's the first part on that. And we can circle back to that one if you want. And then the other one, as far as, so there's a couple things to this. One, I'm not a huge fan of what they call exposure therapy. I believe that really puts the veteran or anyone who's gone through trauma through agonizing pain that is unnecessary. I do believe, however, that narrative therapy is a very, very helpful way to restore a lot of issues within traumatized veterans or returning veterans. And so Dr. Joan Rosenberg out in LA, Air Force veteran and psychiatrist, says that stories heal the brain. And there's a lot of research in Kendall Haven's book, Story Proof, that shows that trauma victims can use story to restore themselves. Now, let me go one step further. If you have endured trauma, as a veteran, a family member, or a civilian, my recommendation is that storytelling should follow. You shouldn't try to tell the story if the story is not resolved. So even though stories can restore kind of your stability, there may not be resolution. So if you've had a traumatic event in your life, let's say you went through a horrific ambush and you know, there are still parts of that memory that torment you. You need to find resolution in that story. And that means professional psychological help. There are amazing, Aaron, post-traumatic stress protocols out there called RTM, ART. There's a whole host of them. If you want, contact me offline at theheroesjourney.org and I can connect you to those. But find resolution first, then use story to restore, right, the, you know, who you are and your stability. There's kind of a sequence to that. I say never tell a story that's traumatic if you have not resolved that story in your heart.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I, again, another link that you have solved for me, I was also missing that link, but I liken it to now, if you don't resolve that trauma and step away from it, then you're just digging yourself in a hole every time you tell that story and the hole keeps getting deeper and deeper.
Yeah, it's not a mental problem. We know this now. It's a memory problem, right? The memory is isolated and stored in the amygdala the way it has been for 100,000 years. Like, it's a survival mechanism. So we need to restore that memory back to where it belongs. But before we can do that, there has to be resolution of that story. Now, psychiatrists, mental health professionals, counselors who are trained in a lot of these recent protocols can use narrative and other non-invasive mechanisms to help you do that, where a lot of our folks are going home and sleeping that night in ways that they haven't slept in years. They're treating this like an injury, not an illness. So my recommendation is, let's get really clear here. If you are suffering from trauma, the first thing I recommend is let's take that on. Let's deal with that and let's get that resolved. And there are protocols out there to help you do that. And then let's start to move into the storytelling realm and use story as a tool to restore ourselves, to restore our relationship and our connections with our community. It becomes then a restorative act. And that's when we start reaching optimal health.
See, that's why I love doing this podcast, because every time I bring somebody on, I learn about new techniques, new research, new ways to help people heal. I'd never heard of narrative therapy before, so thank you for explaining that to me. But also to know that there are so many people out there that have suffered in some way, and now people are actually just talking about it. It's a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. I mean, look, we are, as humans, we are creatures of struggle. We go through trauma. You don't have to be in the military either to experience trauma. You know that. with your work. I mean, you are exposed to trauma all the time. And trauma is part of who we are. And I'm here to tell you, I have witnessed so many warriors and their military family members actually repurpose trauma in the service of others. In fact, right now I am preparing a TEDx talk, my next TEDx talk. I call it The Generosity of Scars. And it is literally the repurposing of one's struggle to serve others, primarily through storytelling. And it's a very powerful tool. It works because it makes you uber relatable. It makes other people see what's possible for their lives when they see someone who has endured trauma and overcome it. And it is an immensely generous leadership tool, if not the most generous leadership tool on the planet.
I love it. Another thing that I've learned. I also learned from you today that saber-toothed tigers make horrible pets, and should probably not get one.
Yeah,
horrible pets.
Absolutely. Man. Yeah. Thanks for picking up on that.
I know. I'm going to have to tell my daughter, no big kitties.
Yeah. Lo siento.
So did you use storytelling as a way to connect to your Afghan counterparts, and how did you relate to them being from a completely different country, a completely different culture?
I did. I mean, I'm a child of Appalachia, so I grew up around storytelling. I've always been a fan of it. But like most Americans, most humans, I've always used instinct in storytelling because we're wired for it. In special forces, because we do have to go in and kind of do the Lawrence of Arabia thing, we have to build rapport. And so, you know, you are more prone, Aaron, to use story when you go into these rough places, because you have to make a connection. So, for example, and I write about this in my book, Game Changers, that chronicles our adventures in these Afghan villages late in the war. For example, the villages I went into, I told stories about my family's tobacco farming because, you know, imagine we're going into these villages that have been at war for 40 years, the very rough way of life. They use 18th century technology for farming. And it's very similar to the type of farming that my family did in the Appalachian Mountains of tobacco. And it was very primitive. It was very rough. My dad would always say it's the only farming in the world where you slowly starve to death while you do it. And Afghans would actually chuckle at that. And we would find a sense of connection. It's called the universal singular in storytelling, where, you know, we would connect around this very hard, rugged aspect of farming. And we didn't talk about Taliban. We didn't talk about ideology. We talked about farming, and we would form a connection there. The relationship would deepen, and then we would just continue to follow that narrative path. And so, yes, I used storytelling all the time to build an initial connection, to deepen the relationship, and to find those universal singular points where we got beyond the trust gaps that existed, and we focused on what connected us. And that's what storytelling can do, and among many other things, is it can bridge those trust gaps, gender gaps, socioeconomic gaps, by creating these universal singulars that we all value and love.
Now, did you find that any one thing that you specifically learned from them that surprised you? Because it sounds like storytelling is not just one person telling their story. It's also the feedback and that connection that you get with the receiver.
Great question. I always tell my students that storytelling is more like a dance, right? Don't think of storytelling as you standing up there speaking at people. That's what a speaker does. A storyteller, this is a living, breathing art form. And it's like a dance. And, you know, Doug Lipman talks about this thing called the storyteller's triangle. And in that, you have the teller, you have the listener, and then you have the story itself, which is a living, breathing thing. So the teller has to have a direct relationship with her story, and she has to have a direct relationship with her audience, right? And those are her two responsibilities. And then the audience forms the base of the triangle by having its own relationship with the story. And so if you think about that, it is a give and take all the time. And so you're absolutely right. The best storytellers on the planet are great listeners. That's what we've learned in my play, Last Out, is when we are doing the play, what our director, Aim Livingston, teaches us is great actors, great storytellers listen better than anyone else around them. Because when you listen and you allow the other party to communicate to you through story, you're going to hear the things that matter most to them, and then you'll be able to repurpose it into your own narrative, which will just deepen the relationship and accelerate the trust. I found, for example, that many rural Afghans valued family. They valued education. They had very, very similar concerns about rural life that I had grown up with. And it was only through listening to their stories. And I even got a better sense of what they wanted out of our presence there. And it wasn't democracy. It was actually a return back to their tribal life that was in place before the Soviets coming. And only through listening deeply to the stories of their past could we ascertain those kinds of potential outcomes.
Wow, that's incredible. And when you think of military and war and everything that goes along with it, you think of blowing shit up and fighting and machine guns. You never ever hear or even imagine that this is an integral part of relations.
It is. And if you think about it, though, think about how most people take action, Aaron. They take action of their own free will. People don't like to be told what to do. They like to be reminded of what's important. And then they want to locate themselves in the story and decide whether or not they're going to climb that ladder into the darkness when the village is under fire and make a stand. And it was really through storytelling, active listening, interpersonal relationships, understanding people's problems, and actually working with them on the problem and not admiring it, that we started to one by one see villagers climb up onto their rooftop and take a stand, until ultimately the entire village was pushing back against the Taliban. And it would usually happen within 2 to 3 weeks. And it is people acting of their own free will. And that's why I think the most relevant leaders today are the ones who can make deep connections. They're the ones who can meet the other party where they are, not where you want them to be. And that involves deep listening. It involves great storytelling. and it involves leaning in and being available and present when you're doing that, and really putting the other party's needs before your own whenever you can. That's kind of how humans have operated for a long time. We've just forgotten that in this transactional world.
Hold on, I'm taking notes. No, seriously, I am. This is great, great stuff. And the way that you present it is super, again, relatable, but also it is easy to integrate into your everyday life. Like, think of all your connections and all your relationships, because we can use these methodologies with our kids. You know, they don't like to be told what to do, but if you give them that relatability and to make the decision to want to do something, it's huge.
It really is. And especially when you think about today, you know, we operate in such a trust depleted world. I mean, in 1972, Gallup took a poll and 1/3 of Americans said they didn't trust their neighbor, which at the time America led the world in its ability to trust itself. And just last year, Americans said 2/3 of Americans said they don't trust their neighbor, and it's climbing. And so we live in a world, our children live in a world that is extremely trust depleted. And it means that, and distracted, right? And because of devices and technology, we're very distracted and disengaged. We lack purpose. So the leaders today who are authentic, the leaders who can inspire people to climb up on those ladders, the leaders who can make deeper connections with those around them, they're the most relevant. I mean, that's the whole, I actually formed a rooftop leadership community where we have an online community of leaders all over the country, because I want to be able to share best practices on, hey, how do you make a deep connection in the moment? How do you connect with someone on your PTA or on the school board? Or how do you show your child how to negotiate through a situation? No one's teaching leaders that today. And it bothers me, because I feel like everything has become so transactional and we've moved so far away from our nature that we're on a course, in my opinion, to return to tribalism. And that scares me, especially for our kids.
Mm-hmm. No, I see the writing on the wall too, and it's very, very scary. But hopefully we can get more people like you, and maybe more people to be influenced by you and to take your methodologies and maybe subvert that a little bit.
I hope so. And I believe every single one of us is capable of it if we simply believe in serving a purpose bigger than ourselves. And this is where I go back to first responders like yourself, or military folks, military families. One thing that unifies all of us is that, for the most part, we believe in serving something bigger than ourselves. And when we come out of the military, we are exposed to a world that doesn't necessarily subscribe to that for a whole host of reasons. And we cannot allow that to alter who we are. We cannot allow that local reality that we've now stepped into to move us away from that deeper sense of purpose and service. In fact, we've got to go back to that and anchor to it. And it's storytelling that can help us rediscover who we are, what our purpose is, where we've been, and how all of those miles and scars are relevant and serve people in this civilian world who are so damn hungry for it. You know, that's, to me, the power of storytelling in its purest form, is that it is the vehicle by which we can stay connected to that deep purpose and deliver it to the people who need it here in the civilian world.
Psh, mind blown. I've got nothing to respond to that. That was amazing. So, speaking of storytelling and using it to fulfill a purpose, let's talk about Last Out.
Okay.
Tell me about it.
Oh, I love it. I'm so proud of it, and I'm proud of what it's doing in the world. I am a speaker, storyteller, and, you know, I've been taking classes with acting coaches to just be a better storyteller. And about 2 years ago, we had to do a project, a one-person show, 5 minutes, with a totem from our life. And I brought in a silly band. We called it the Magic Silly Band, that my son Braden gave to me, that would keep me safe in Afghanistan. And I told the story as the silly band about how different senior officers had tried to get me to take it off, and how I'd survived ambushes, and I'd stayed, and I'd brought my, you know, my master home safe to Braden. And by the time I was done, people were like weeping, you know, and they were like, that's a play. And I, you know, at first I didn't take it that seriously, but I'd never written a play. I started writing it kind of for me. But before long, I started asking people for help, which is another great thing that we should do as transitioning veterans, because people do want to help you build something if you're building it bigger than yourself. People saw what I was writing. had some great mentors come in and help me write this thing. And before long, I looked around, before long, 2 years later, it was a play. It was Last Out, Elegy of a Green Beret. And it's a story about a Green Beret sergeant, Aaron, who is killed in the very first scene of the play. And he wants to go to the warrior resting place of Valhalla so he can finally know peace. He wants to just let go. But he's holding on to something, and he can't let go of it. And so his buddies come down from Valhalla, and they help him go back through his life, and they shapeshift to become the different people, his wife, his son, his best friend, his nemesis. And they take him through his life so that he can figure out what he's holding on to. And so he can finally go home and know peace. And in doing that, it's an 85-minute white-knuckle ride through Danny's entry into Special Forces pre-9/11, how he met his wife, had his son, 9/11, he was in the Pentagon, and then just deployment after deployment as you see the wheels come off the bus with himself, his family, until he's back at that moment where he was killed and he finally figures it out. And it will help civilians at an emotional level understand the impact of war on our society. And it will validate the nobility of the struggle of our warriors and their family members. And it's crazy powerful. I play the leading role along with a cast of veterans, and we're on a 20-city tour right now.
Wow. That is incredible. I have to see it. So we'll talk about where you're going to be, because that is, woo.
Yeah. So let me say this. If you want to get a sense of the play, go to lastoutplay.com. Click the media tab. There's all these very cool videos there, but click the one that says Gold Star Son, and you'll just get a sense of how powerful the play is, and the effect that it had on one Gold Star Son. And then just watch all the other videos on there, and it'll hook you in. It'll suck you right in, and it'll make you want to come see the play big time.
So the creation of this play, it took you 2 years to develop, correct?
2 years to write it, and then another 6 months to find the actors and get the play on its feet.
Was that the jumping off point for you to be courageous and passionate enough to put yourself out there, or were you already doing some sort of storytelling and this was just kind of a bigger concept of it?
Wow, what a great question. I like to think, Aaron, that I was already putting myself out there as a storyteller, but nowhere near what this play required. And it's so cool of you to pick up on that, because one of the things that is required for us as storytellers, and this is where a lot of veterans balk, this is where a lot of first responders balk, is we have to have emotional access to the story. We have to have emotional access to our own journey. Because if we don't, it's just a speech, right? It's just a monologue. It means very little to the listener, because of how we're wired as humans. We feel a story before we hear it. And so this play required, because it is so deeply personal and it's so close to reality, both the sadness and horror and comedy of combat, that it requires me and all of the actors to just take all the body armor off and literally bear our soul on stage to show the utter madness of a nightmare with PTS. And so, yeah, I had to just go a whole new level on it. I had to take acting classes in New York, breathing classes, learning how to deal with trauma in real time. It still is. It's very tough, but it's what it's taught me, Aaron, is that as storytellers, all of us must allow ourselves to feel the stories we tell.
And that's so hard, because I think a lot of us get to that point where we see like little mini successes here or there, or, you know, talk to someone who's supportive and says, hey, you know, you're really great at this. Maybe you should do a TEDx talk, or maybe you should, you know, write your own songs and perform them at open mic night. You get to that precipice where you basically have to jump, and fear holds you back. The opinion of others holds you back. And you just kind of took that one big jump, leap, and flew. So what do you say to people who are at that point where they're feeling something and they're almost there, but they're afraid of what people on social media are going to say or what their family's going to say, once they're so open and vulnerable and all of these demons and thoughts and feelings come out? How do we get over that?
I say pursue it at all costs. I say pursue it as if your life depended on it, because I believe it does. You know, as veterans, as first responders, as people who have lived our life in the pursuit of something bigger than ourselves, right? If you think about it that way, when we were in the military, when we were doing that work, when we were responding to fires or domestic disturbances, we were fully expressed. We didn't worry about what people around us thought. We ran to the sound of the guns. We ran towards the smoke. We were fully expressed. We knew exactly who we are, what we stood for, and what we were about. And we didn't apologize for shit, because that's who we are. And my belief is that when you come home into this world, what's killing us, what's causing us to self-medicate, what's causing us to go off the grid, is that we stop doing that. It's not because we start doing it. It's because we stop. And we owe it to ourselves. We owe it to our spirit. We owe it to the miles and our scars to continue to do it. And it seems scary because it is a new environment and we have to find our voice again, but it's the same work. And if we don't do it, then that to me is the most dangerous thing we can do, because then it becomes the life unlived. Then it becomes, you know, doing what everyone else wants you to do instead of what you believe. And yeah, there'll be trauma and yeah, there'll be pain, but who gives a shit? Like, that's been our whole life, right? And so for me, it's about, if I don't, people, one person asked me, why in God's name would you learn to act at age 50 and do this play? And what I said was, if I don't, I'll die. If I don't, it'll kill me. And that's how I feel. And I believe that we should pursue whatever's next in our life with that same level of passion, because you've earned the right to do that.
That is incredible. I am inspired, absolutely inspired to jump off that ledge and fly.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have, you know, look, I'm not saying that it's not, you know, that you got to prepare. You just, like, okay, so, you know, in the military or in law enforcement or whatever, you know, we were, yes, we took risks, right? Yes, we did things that other people look at us and go, you're crazy. But we also did the deep work. We didn't just flail ourselves off into the abyss. Like, we trained, we looked at what was required. We laid it out. And then we did the work. We did the deep work necessary. We did the work when no one was looking. We trained on our own. We trained at night when everyone else was sleeping. We got up at 5:30 a.m. and we did PT, right? I mean, and then we mitigated the risk down to the lowest possible level. And then we stepped out of the airplane, knowing that if our main chute didn't open, the training that we had done with our reserve would allow us to have an almost guaranteed sense of success, even though it looked crazy. This is no different. Right. So if we're challenged by trauma, if we're challenged by a technical skill that we don't know yet, well, so, okay, figure out what the requirement is and approach it with the same tenacity and veracity that you used in your prior life. Like, that's the key. And really open your, but be willing to be vulnerable, be willing to look stupid, be willing to endure the emotional pain necessary for your brain to learn a new skill, whether it's a hard skill or a soft skill. And I think that's where we're missing the boat, Aaron, because because it's a new world. We feel like we're supposed to pull back somehow and be measured and do. That's crazy. We never did that before we stepped into this new world. So why would we start now?
And the key, I think, too, you kind of briefly touched upon it, is to be intentional.
To be intentional. Absolutely. To be present, to be available, to be connected to your nature, and to fulfill on what it is that you know you're supposed to do next. Because for most of us, if not all of us, when we are still at night and we're breathing and we're in our body, we know exactly what it is we're supposed to do. It's just that it scares the crap out of us. And that we know that everyone around us is going to say, don't do it. You're going to get hurt, right? You're going to get hurt if you go do this. And we feel so damn exposed, because it's such a new world. But my opinion is, press on the gas and do the work. Do the work. A great book I would recommend to anyone listening to this podcast is The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. And it is a great book on how to live into what it is you're born to do and how to overcome this thing called resistance, or the self-sabotage that puts itself between us and our higher goals.
I wrote it down, and we'll also have it in the link section too, so people can just click on it and check it out.
Great. That's awesome. Yeah. But yeah, so the play is, you know, it is my labor of love right now. Our nonprofit, The Hero's Journey, is the production company. We're taking it all over the country. My goal is that it gets made into a movie or a streaming series on Netflix and that it goes off Broadway. I mean, I'm really serious about, and most of all, that it becomes the national vehicle for a conversation about a multi-generational war that's going on right now. We are, for the first time in history, Americans are sending their children to fight the war that they didn't finish. And my sense is that our politicians and most of our civilians do not understand that reality. And we need to remind those decision makers and those citizens about the cost of war. No problem if we want to send our sons and daughters off to fight, but we damn sure better know what we're asking them to do. And I don't know that that's true right now.
I'm definitely hearing that a lot, actually. Yeah. You know, it's not just so much of, well, you know what you were getting into when you signed up. We need to support these people and make sure that we keep them around. They're not disposable.
They are not disposable. My son was 3 years old when the towers fell, and next year he'll be a lieutenant. Okay. And he's going to go fight the war with the same strategy I had. Now, there's something wrong with that. Again, it's not that I object to my son serving. I'm proud of him. However, I don't believe that the political environment reflects both administrations, right? Both sides of the aisle reflect the deep knowledge necessary about what it is that we're sending our sons and daughters to do. And same with our citizenry. I don't believe there is a deep enough awareness that every time that we throw troops at a hotspot in the world, it's the same people. It's not like this, we get to reset and send a new batch of young people. It's the same people, the same families that are enduring deployment after deployment. And that's fine if it's necessary, but I'm not sure that we truly understand the depth of these, you know, ongoing year after year deployments on a very small percentage of Americans. And that's what this play's about. That's why it's called Last Out.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think as civilians, we understand that this is a situation that's happening. So I'm so glad and thankful that you were bringing this to us. And I want everybody who was within the area that you guys are performing this to consider checking it out.
Please.
At least, you know, come in with an open mind and at least, if nothing else, you get 85 minutes of entertainment.
Absolutely. And look, whether you're, we've had people in the audience who are opposed to war. We've had people in the audience who are pro-war. It doesn't really matter to me. What matters to me is that you, at an emotional level, can feel the impact of war. And then whatever stance you take is informed by that emotion, not some BS 30-second soundbite on CNN or Fox News by a politician who has no skin in the game.
Absolutely. Now, do you have a lot of veterans that are in your crew in the involved in the whole, either the back part of the production or how important is it to have them involved in this?
It's critical. I mean, for me, you know, not only having veterans on the stage, but having veterans in our nonprofit production company on the team that travels with us. We travel with a team of 12, and like our tour manager, Carrie Ellis, she is an Air Force spouse. She lost her husband to suicide 2 years ago. My wife, Monty, is a 24-year, Army spouse who has, been to probably more funerals than I have. Our logistics team, is Chris and Jimmy, an Iraqi veteran blown up and buried alive in his Jeep or his Humvee, and the other one lost his leg in Afghanistan. Our lighting designer, Will, is an Army veteran. I mean, on and on it goes. It's very deep. And it means a lot to have that team together when we travel, because we treat it truly like a Special Forces A team. We are very tight.
It's like the ripple effect. It just keeps going out and out and out.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And they, they take care of us on the stage, but they also know how to take care of the audience. We also travel with a counselor, Dr. Diego Hernandez, who is trained in both protocols for PTS that I told you about. In every city we go to, whenever we do the talkbacks after the show, anyone who self-identifies with PTS, Doc grabs them, takes them off to the side and does interventions right there in the lobby. It's amazing.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. That is so cool.
Yep. Yeah. We don't just admire the problem. Remember, that brings us back to what we talked about in the beginning is this play illuminates so many issues in our society around the hard topic of war. But when we travel to these communities where we go, these different communities, we want to bring a level of resilience and solution to the problem. and certainly having Doc on hand is a big step toward that. We also train counselors, if they want it, in those communities while we're in town so that they can build their own counselor support for those protocols and have that resilience in town and not be reliant on the VA or whatever. They have their own PTS capacity in the community for not just veterans, but first responders.
Wow, that is incredible. What a gift.
Awesome. Yeah, it's awesome. And what's cool, Aaron, is, and I think this is true for all of our veterans listening to this, is I think if you have the audacity to pursue something bigger than yourself when you leave service and stay on that path that you were in the military towards that sense of service, the universe rewards that. I believe we're not only gifted with stories that change lives, but also others will come to your aid and help you build it. And I've just experienced that for six straight years. It wasn't without its hard times and its challenges and its dark moments, but a lot of people have come to the fight that I never expected. And, you know, that whole PTS thing is one of them.
Well, whatever you need from me, I'm here. I'll do whatever you need. That's
I appreciate that.
I would love to help.
Well, you need to come see the play.
I will. Yes.
Yeah. We're going to probably the closest to you will be Santa Barbara in early 2020. So we'll get you there one way or the other.
Okay. That's enough time to plan.
Okay.
And what kind of feedback have you been getting from veterans about how your efforts have helped their mental health?
We've gotten a lot of really powerful feedback, and understand that the way I operate is I'm very much just like I was when I was a Green Beret. I'm very hands-on. You know, I talk eyeball to eyeball to our veterans and their family members. I train them personally in storytelling, and then I stay in touch with them and I watch them as they develop and evolve. And so I'm constantly getting anecdotal feedback from them on you know, how it's working. For example, Andrew Einstein, Marine, Civil Affairs Sergeant, Russian pineapple grenade blew up next to him in Afghanistan, traumatic brain injury. He came home and was suicidal. A year later, he was in our story training program with the Hero's Journey. And, you know, now he is on the law enforcement department in Pennsylvania, and he is the leading advocate for preventing law enforcement suicide in the state of Pennsylvania. And he uses his story that we trained him on to help other law enforcement officers identify suicidal behavior before it manifests in their life. And he's using story to do that. And so we're seeing this all over the place. We're seeing this with adaptive sports figures. We train them in storytelling, playing wheelchair rugby, you know, Spartan race, like a lot, Aaron. And mostly it's when we train veterans on how to use their story to serve a bigger purpose. That's where we're getting the feedback, and that's where we're focusing our effort.
Awesome. So you've been out of the military, I mean, loosely said, because you're still very passionate about it. You're still involved in it. But
Yeah. Do
you still have any battles or challenges in context of your military experience about transitioning to civilian life that you're still dealing with?
I do. In fact, I was talking to one of my best friends today, David Martin, who is a civilian. He's never served. He's really the guy that got me into the corporate world, where I do a lot of teaching and corporate leadership and speaking. And, you know, I coach him. I actually coach him and on life coaching, performance coaching, and as I do other people. And he was asking me almost a similar question. He's like, well, you know, you seem to have it all together. And I said, David, you know what? With this play that we're doing right now, I pretty much want to quit every single day. I don't feel like I'm the right guy to get on the stage. I don't feel like people will want to hear my message when we go to a new town. I'm worrying what my peers are going to think from the military, you know, all that stuff. I'm dealing with it all the time. All those insecurities and self-doubt, you know, I'm throwing up in the toilet before I walk out on the stage, even though I've been on hundreds of stages. And what I've come to realize, though, is that I had those same feelings before a combat mission. I had those same feelings before we would go in and clear a room, or we would go into a village. It's the same feelings of self-doubt and unworthiness. But that is what Stephen Pressfield calls resistance. It is the negative forces that exist in our body. And the higher the purpose, the higher the goals, the higher the resistance. And it's about learning to identify that when it shows up in your life and not letting it take your knees out. And we learned how to do it in the military. We learned how to do it in law enforcement. But for some reason, when we come to the civilian world, we disconnect from our purpose and it takes us out. And so, yes, I still deal with it all the time. It's probably stronger than it's ever been. But I fight that battle every single day And I use high, you know, regimen and ritual and training to keep it at bay and to show up and do my damn work every day. And when I do that, I win, and I win one day at a time.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because that was super vulnerable. And to know that you do doubt yourself, because you come across very highly confident and self-assured, but it's kind of good to know that you still have those doubts, but you overcome them every single day.
It goes back to your question originally, Aaron, about relatability. I tell people all the time, when you tell your stories, don't puff your chest out and talk about all the great things you did. What actually causes people to connect you in your story and in your hero's journey is when you talk about the pivotal moment that you experienced in your life and the struggle that ensued, the enemies inside, outside, both that you had to overcome and battle, and how you got your butt kicked. That's actually when people choose you. That's when you're the most relatable, is when you share the struggle that you've gone through in your life. And it doesn't matter if you're a bank president or the leader of a nonprofit or a battalion commander in the army, being relatable about the struggles that you go through is exactly what it means to be vulnerable. Vulnerability scares people off. I say, don't worry about vulnerability. Worry about being relatable by talking honestly about the struggles that you face and that you faced in your life.
Awesome. That's perfect. If we haven't talked about any of these points yet, is there anything else that you want to give to veterans that may be having a tough time dealing with their transition?
Yeah, I would say that I certainly did. The first year or two that I was coming out of service was very dark for me. I wrote a book called Mission America. You can find it at theheroesjourney.org, and it's about transition. But most of us coming out of service experience what my mentor Dave Phillips called snakes in the head. And it's where you really go through mood swings and dark periods. You question your self-worth, your identity. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with a disconnection of our purpose and our identity as humans. When we leave the military, where we were so fully expressed, where we knew exactly who we were, we disconnect from that. And we start doing what everybody else wants us to do. So what I would say is this: no matter where you are in your life, if you're 1 year out from transition, or you're 10 years after transition, or if you served in Vietnam, do the work to get clear on the purpose that you're here to serve in your life. Get away off grid and start trying to rediscover that. What is it that makes you tick? What are you about? What are the tracks that you want to leave in this world 15 years after you're gone? Like, get clear on that purpose. And then identify the story, your own hero's journey, the pivotal moment that happened, a pivotal moment that happened in your life, the struggle you went through to overcome it, and what you learned or how you changed as a result of that. That's a very, very powerful thing as well, is having the story that articulates your purpose and what you're about. And, you know, finally, I would say, whatever it is that lights you up, even if it scares the hell out of you, especially if it scares the hell out of you, pursue it with everything you've got, because life is short and there's nothing worse than to look around at the end of your life and realize that you didn't fulfill on something that you could have. Because as a veteran or a law enforcement person, you've earned that right more than anybody. And to not pursue it is just a tragedy. So those are the things that I think, and I think we've covered them, but, you know, get clear on your purpose, tell your story, you know, really develop your own hero's journey. Chapter 16 of Mission America tells you how to do it. And then go for it. Go for those passions and objectives that are bigger than you. Don't be afraid to pursue them. Because that's the good stuff that life's made of.
Again, you've left me speechless. That's amazing. So we're running out of time. I know you are a very busy guy and you have lots of things you probably have to do, but you've talked about some organizations and nonprofits that you're involved in. Can you list them off and how we can get a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So if you want to see the play, or even if you just want to learn more about the play, go to lastoutplay.com. Next would be, if you want to get deeper on storytelling, there's a couple of options here. Well, okay, so theheroesjourney.org, and that's the heroes, plural, H-E-R-O-E-S, journey.org. If you go to that and you're a veteran, there is a free 7-module storytelling course online, or first responder, that I've developed. It's the same one I teach to corporate America. It's really good, that you can enroll in for free. And it can help you craft that story that I was talking about. There's absolutely no excuse. And you can do it in the privacy of your own home, on your own mobile device. It's solid. And it's got a course guide that goes with it. So you go to theheroesjourney.org. It's right there. And I strongly recommend that. Also, if you go to my for-profit side, rooftopleadership.com, there's a ton. If you go to the blog section, there's like 60 free video blogs of me by the fire pit talking about how to make better human connections in your life. I mean, that alone, if you just did that, you could 10x accelerate your connection skills and storytelling skills as a leader. So I'll leave it there. Those are the areas that, I mean, could totally, in like 4 months, 120 days, you could totally show up differently as a leader.
Well, thank you for sharing those gifts with us. I will have all those links in your episode page so that people can just find it super, super easy. And if they wanted to connect with you directly, is that possible? Do you take personal email or?
Yeah, I mean, probably the easiest way. So Scott at rooftopleadership.com is totally fine. You can also message me on Facebook. I'm pretty responsive. Yeah, I mean, either one of those is fine.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Scott. And yeah. Do you have any closing thought for us as we finish up today?
Look, here's the thing is if you look around the world today, Aaron, what you're doing is really important. And, you know, encouraging people to tell their story and to find the contributions and the value in their life through their story. This is an age-old, timeless, universal application of leadership. And the interesting thing is that in our world today, most people have stopped doing it. We've become so transactional and trust depleted that the people around you are not doing it. And frankly, I don't think anybody else is coming. If we're waiting for leaders to come off, you know, riding over the hilltop on the white horse with the big hat, I'm not sure that's going to happen. I believe that leadership starts with us. It starts with those of us coming out of the military. It starts with the military families. It starts with first responders. We are the ones who run to the sound of the guns and who run to the smoke. And we've got to continue. The world needs our leadership. Communities need our leadership. Our kids need that leadership. And this is not some cliche BS that I'm throwing out there. I spend every second of every day dealing with leadership issues in our country. And whether it's terrorism, law enforcement, corporate America, nonprofits, veterans advocacy, I'm in it every day, sticking and moving. And I'm telling you, your story and the miles you've run and the scars you've accumulated are what the people in this world need to take action. And the more courage you have to do that, the more generous you are with your scars, the more the universe will reward you with the purpose that you're pursuing. And I believe it to my core. And so I would encourage anybody out there who's stuck to just reconnect to your purpose and start telling that story because it will free you up.
Wow. Thank you so much, Scott, for being here. It has been a true pleasure. If nobody else got anything out of this hour, I did. And mm-hmm. I think that's highly valuable. So I appreciate you taking the time out from your busy, busy schedule to come talk to us and to share your story.
You're very welcome, Aaron. And thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen today. And I hope that you found something that really resonates with you. I can't wait to share even more. So please subscribe to the podcast. And you can find links to our resources in the description and at youroxygenmaskfirst.com.